instead of a left that sees how do we produce what's needed, we have a left that sees how do we protect people from harm. And that's really where environmental politics comes in. How do we protect everyone from an extra molecule of carbon or something? Like, it's warranted in a lot of ways. There were in the 70s, like, I don't want to be seen as dismissing the environmental movement. Some of the victories in the 60s and 70s are absolutely critical, like cleaning up rivers, cleaning up the air. Clean air is an extremely popular, important demand. That is a wonderful thing that has been cleaned up dramatically. So I don't want to dismiss the interest in protecting people from harm in this environmental sense, but I do think that is where the left has been at. And to kind of connect it to today, now, and whenever Matt and I are writing about this stuff, we kind of preface everything with, if we care about decarbonization, there is a legitimate reason to want to grow the electric sector to meet this demand for all this new electricity. And I think that is generally accepted. So today is a left that sees, hey, the capitalists are not producing enough of this thing that needs to be produced, electricity, in a way that's equitable, but also just in terms of like sheer volume, they're not doing it.
Hello everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. This is Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil. And today we are, we are also Lee Phillips, new contributor. Welcome.
Hello. I guess I'm popping my Bunga cherry here as a, Bunga person.
Sitting on the Bunga side of the table. I hope it's warm and comfortable for you. This is an episode in partnership with Damage Magazine. You probably already know, subscriber, that we are partnered with Damage Magazine. By subscribing to our Patreon, you get a free subscription to Damage. And today we are discussing an article which appeared in Damage Magazine, or rather a series of articles which have appeared in the first and second editions of Damage. The first one being Building Big Things, and the second one, which is just out, is called Deinstitutionalized. And we're going to be talking about power, about and the institutions involved in producing, generating, distributing, and consuming power. So to do that, we are joined today by Fred Stafford, who's a STEM professional, a writer on energy and power, and also an editor at Damage Magazine. Fred Stafford is a pseudonym designed to protect his true identity. But hello, Fred.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here. Long time listener.
Yeah, excellent. So very excited to finally be doing this and to be talking about power, about who owns power, who runs power. Where does it all come from? As a consequence of my relative lack of knowledge in these technical areas, Lee's going to be asking a lot of the questions here today. But I want to get us started and ask what a utility is. Is it like pornography, where most people know what it is when they see it, but maybe can't really describe it? I don't know if I would be able to tell you what a utility is, whether it's necessarily public. Is it a question of ownership? Is it a question of structure or of purpose? What makes a utility, Fred?
So that is a great question. Good place to start. So a utility, and I think today generally people are talking about electric utilities when they talk about that. The way most people think of utility is it's the company that sends them the bill every month for electricity usage, maybe also power and gas usage, but primarily electricity usage. So it generally is a entity that gets a lot of ire from people, rightfully, for those damn prices keep going up. The labor leader, American labor leader Tony Mizaki, in the 70s. He once described the most radical piece of literature in the average home is the utility bill that people receive every month. So that's kind of the starting point. And you could think of it as like the end use customer perspective of the electricity system is via your utility. They're the company that's going to be owning and maintaining the local electrical lines that lead to your home from other things that we're not going to talk about yet. But they're kind of locally embedded in your city, in your neighborhood. Their customers are you, me, everyone we know, but then also business customers, commercial customers, factories, things like that. And in most places, they both own that local electrical infrastructure, which doesn't necessarily include power plants or anything, just lines. And they are the ones billing you for that. So that's kind of the starting point. And then the next level out is, okay, let's forget just the local part of that. Obviously, I'm getting power from, one lives in a building somewhere in a city, and one doesn't see power plants directly around them, probably. So where does it come from? Well, because the local distribution system is connected to a larger high voltage transmission system that is also connected to a bunch of power plants and generators, and that's what we call the bulk power system. So the utility is kind of your direct exposure into this larger thing called the electricity grid, which is managed by utilities and other companies and other entities and authorities that are keeping this insanely complicated, kind of magically still running pretty well machine of the electrical grid going at all times.
Right. So, I mean, I don't want to sound get too kind of wanky about this, but it seems like the utility is somewhat an artifact of the consumer's perspective on things, and maybe objectively, it might not be what it appears to be for, you know, to the consumer. Is that right? Or
that's exactly right. I mean, like, I think if you are somewhere, your utility is, let's call it capitalist power and light. You often see blah blah power and light is like the old fashioned name of utilities.
Yeah.
So capitalist power and light, you might think like, well, they're giving me all this electricity. They must own everything, but they're embedded in this much larger system. So when capitalist power and light came about, let's say in the early 20th century, they certainly did own some local power plants and other generators and the lines and all that. And they really kind of managed it as this totally vertically integrated thing. It wasn't connected necessarily to this much larger grid. But in like a city, for example, they kind of owned all the lines and maintained that, operated that. They were socializing the costs of all this infrastructure to all of the consumers, the ratepayers, as they're called. And it's kind of over the course of the 20th century that the need for electricity just starts rising and rising and rising for commercial and industrial reasons, new factories and things that are using that electric power, but also new home goods, street lights. That's where the power and light comes from, the fact that they were also running the electricity for the lights in the city. So as electricity use is climbing, they need to build out more and more infrastructure. And so these massively capital intensive utility companies had to keep expanding and had to keep on finding new places to put in plants and generators and expanding out. And let me back up for a second. The fact that they could even do that at all, the fact that they're a thing called a utility and not just I'm some random company that happened to set up these lines, well, it could have been the case in the very early 20th century that some other capitalist set up some lines and was trying to fight for customers, and they would have to duke it out. And they would have to set up like crisscrossing lines that were kind of overlaid on top of each other. That's like a bunch of redundant expenses. And that's why this came to be seen as those lines, that infrastructure is a natural monopoly, like natural gas for lighting and railroads were thought to be. So in the early 20th century, the idea of them as a public utility really came about because of the need for them to be able to get financing to build out this infrastructure more. Because if you have to fight against these other capitalists for all those customers, you're going to have a hard time convincing a bank to give you money for these enormously capital intensive infrastructure for all those lines and things. So if you can get a franchise from a state, and in the US, this is always kind of done at the state level. If you can get a franchise from the state that says you are the monopoly utility, you are a public utility to provide electric service to this territory, and now you have a monopoly. No one else can steal your customers. So now you can go to the bank and get a giant loan to do this huge capital expense, and we will let you get a somewhere around 9-10% return on the capital investment as long as you operate this stuff and you meet kind of your public need to provide that public service.
So it was actually in the interests of these companies to submit to regulation by the state, in service of profit. They would make more profit than what would happen with respect to the volatility of competition.
Yes, that's exactly right. So and I should mention Matt Huber, a professor at Syracuse University in the U.S. He is a collaborator of mine on all these damage essays and some other work we've done together. So in our most recent damage essay, The Utility of Utilities, that is really an essential point, what you were just saying, Lee. The idea that utility came about, it kind of seems like, I think it's lost that there were really, this arose as a compromise from two different directions. The capitalist side of that, the need to industrialize and sell power from like electric power titans, like this guy, Samuel Ensel, he was really the one that drove in towards the utility model because they needed that franchise. They needed that monopoly so as not to compete with the other capitalists, so as to be able to convince the banks to give them the loans they needed. Electric power was then, still today, one of the most capital intensive industries in at least the US economy. You just need huge outlays of capital for that. So the ease with which you can convince banks to give you that capital is really important. The other direction this was coming from was that you had kind of the capital P progressives in the early 20th century in the US, a movement of people kind of looking at good governance and thinking about the public interest and the damage issue deinstitutionalized. They were kind of the ones looking out for, thinking that we needed mental health institutions and things like that. But so the kind of progressives, they saw it as, well, this model of utility regulation, this is also kind of a progressive thing to protect the public interest, because the capitalist power and light as a public utility, yes, we're going to allow them to have a 10% return on any of the capital investments they make on our behalf. But because it's on our behalf, we're going to have state commissions that are going to open their books and approve these expenditures. And basically, the idealized model is like they're going to say yay or nay on what this company is going to do. The company has the incentive to gold plate everything because they profit off of the more capital they invest in. So the commission on the other side of that, it's kind of this dialectic thing. They are going to be watching out for the public interest. So that was kind of this, we call it like the yin and yang that led to the utility model of developing electricity as a service.
Right. And so this model, the regulated investor-owned utility model emerged in this period. This is in the United States. I'm in Canada at the moment. And in many provinces, we have fully vertically integrated distribution, transmission, and generation in a single state-owned utility. In British Columbia, it's called BC Hydro. In Ontario, in Quebec, it's Hydro-Quebec. How does the still privately owned regulated investor utility model in the United States differ from that, from a direct public ownership model? Because you do actually have in some places in the United States direct public ownership, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority or the Bonneville Power Administration.
Mm-hmm. So if we stay kind of 100 years ago, and because now we're going to say, okay, it's all vertically integrated, and now we're talking about public ownership in Canada versus private ownership in a lot of the U.S. Not all of the U.S., because there were also municipal utilities that were set up all across America in the early 20th century. But I think the key thing is that these were mostly all vertically integrated. They would own the plants, the lines, and all this stuff to locally provide power for, say, a city. So I think that between like the public, and then I want to be clear, the term utility, I kind of prefer to just say utility, but public utility is the classic notion of that thing. Even when it's not publicly owned, it might be investor owned, but it's still a public utility because it's in the public interest. But a utility company that's owned by investors versus one that's publicly owned, it's that incentive I said to grow and build. And the fact that you're going to literally give better returns to the shareholders if you can convince the commission to allow you to build bigger infrastructure, build more infrastructure, maybe more resilient infrastructure. So it's not like it's a bad thing per se, but it does mean that they have that incentive. So for really, for decades now, the mindset of a kind of progressive, liberal-minded people has been those damn utilities. They're always trying to invest in shit that's not needed, and we have to stop them. And it's like,
right.
You have to control it because, yes, they are capitalist firms. They are looking out for profit. But the way they make the profit is really pretty different in this utility model from most things in the economy, which is a distinction I'm sure we'll get into in a bit. But yeah, it's the fact that the public ownership, they can still kind of manage the vertically integrated electricity service and still say, well, anytime we're going to invest in a new plant, a new infrastructure, we're going to socialize it to the consumers. We're going to set the price, the retail price that everyone's paying. The commissions are going to help set those prices so that the investment will be recouped over some lifetime.
Right. So now in the heart of your article, you talk about how in the 1970s, this model began to break down, and the price shocks of the energy crisis, the emerging neoliberal consensus response to economic stagnation, much more broadly than questions around electricity. And of course, also, as you mentioned, sort of kitchen sink concerns. And you were talking about sort of the quote from Tony Mazzocchi there earlier about the most radical document in a household is the the power bill. And then, of course, reemergence of Malthusian environmentalism, of things like the Limits to Growth Report, the Population Bomb bestseller, and Small is Beautiful. It all came together in a sort of perfect storm that drove the breakup of these regulated utilities and the emergence of independent power producers, or IPPs. Could you tell us in more detail about how this perfect storm came together?
Yeah. I didn't really talk about it yet, but during the New Deal in America in the 30s, there was a lot of, as you mentioned, you alluded to the Tennessee Valley Authority. There was a lot of political interest in setting up public power because there was a general mindset that electricity is modernity. It's going to electrify homes. It's going to lead to, like dishwasher, laundry, and all that stuff is going to be using electricity. Farms are going to get electricity. It's going to revolutionize life. So electricity was really seen as this like inherently positive sign of modernity. We want to grow and build. And through the post-war era, grow and build of the electricity sector is exactly what the utilities have been. That whole structure of how they're organized and the way they make profits exactly leads to growing and building. And the idea is that if I'm going to make a huge capital investment, if I can maximize the effectiveness or kind of the operations of that investment to squeeze out every juice of electricity I can and sell it, then it will lead to lower prices for everyone versus if I could only sell half of that juice, because now the prices will have to go up for that half to recoup the same investment. So there was a legitimate reason why getting both expanding the number of customers, but also getting people to use more electricity was seen as like kind of helping lower prices. At the same time utilities were expanding, they were buying new generators, new power plants. Manufacturers like Westinghouse of the generators, they were, because they had so many utilities around the country pouring in to demand more generators from them, they worked on a lot of technical efficiencies that led to more and more efficient generators to really get more bang for the buck, not just for the utility, but all of the consumers, all the like people, businesses, everything. So that was kind of the model post-war. It is an industry that exploded. And at the same time it exploded, it was a positive thing, I would say, overall. A lot of that explosion was in coal plants, and there was a lot of non-positive aspects of that. And that's really where in the 60s, a kind of burgeoning environmental movement starts to see the grow and build ethos or kind of dynamics of the utility industry, of the electric sector, as being like, hey, maybe that's kind of fucked up, actually. And for, I would say, for legitimate reasons. At the same time, as you were saying, and we talked about in the article, fossil fuels start to become very expensive in the 60s. It's really interesting. I mean, Matt, my co-author Matt, was formerly a scholar of, or maybe still is, a scholar of oil. So he could say a lot more about these kind of historical fossil fuels issues, but really culminating in the 70s with the Arab oil embargo, suddenly there is a lot less oil to be purchased and at much higher prices. At the same time, a lot of the power plants are burning oil. In fact, they've been converted to burn oil instead of coal because of, in the 1960s, there was so much coal pollution in cities. Like in New York City, there's a classic photo from the New York Times first front page of just smog across all of Manhattan because there was so much coal power pollution everywhere. People realized, oh, burning oil produces a lot less smog. So there was a switch to oil, but now the oil prices are skyrocketing. So now electricity, the price of producing electricity starts skyrocketing. So for customers, for consumers of electricity, suddenly all these prices start going up. And the way the response to that is effectively conservation. And that was both the kind of, as I said, kitchen sink response to it of, you know, hey, honey, we should, you know, run the air conditioning less. We should do this less. But also politically, that was the kind of ideological response that in the 70s, the thinking became, we have to conserve. We have to harmonize with nature by not destroying nature with all these big power plants and things. So conservation is not just an economic reality. It's kind of a moral and ideologically important thing. So that was kind of ideologically. Then you have like every Tom, Dick, and Harry and like their response to it. Then you have businesses and production. Factories and things that are consuming electricity to run, they start shutting down. They find that they're going to lose less money if they just don't produce. So it was almost like so that's why like degrowth starts to become more of a mindset in the 70s, like a catchphrase or a no growth, I think it was called then. So that is really where this challenge to the sort of grow and build strategy of utilities and the way that industry was always organized for decades now really came to a head. And there was generally, with the rise of neoliberalism, a need to reform that.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much the change to what is common sense, that change in consciousness, can all be tracked back to the early 70s and that crisis. And we're still kind of living in the world created by that crisis. And, you know, ideas like, you know, that there should be a kind of a break on demand, self-imposed, is something which, you know, is now so kind of a common sense idea that it's hard to even inquire at it very much and go, well, hang on, actually, maybe it'd be good if everyone was just consuming more energy and like people would produce more energy and there's this virtuous cycle, you know, which you were depicting very well. And it seems like very much a different world. Lee.
Just to dig into this a little bit deeper with, you know, Jimmy Carter kicking off the sort of deregulation at the end of the 70s and the emergence of these independent power producers. Could you explain what an IPP is?
Yeah. So IPP, independent power producer, they're also called merchant generators. Back then they were called non-utility generators. I don't know if anyone actually said NUG. But to me, it's kind of humorous. Like those nugs.
It also sounds like they don't provide utility. Like they're useless.
that is a major part of it, actually. So during the Jimmy Carter years in 1978, he passes the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, PURPA, and it has a number of things in it. But there's kind of a secret little blink and you'll miss it aspect of that. That is detailed in this wonderful book, Power Loss, by Richard Hirsch. And that little part of it, because he now, for the first time, there was no like real national energy plan in the United States until the 70s. So as part of one plank of this was that we want to promote alternative energies that aren't going to burn expensive foreign fossil fuels and that are going to help us harmonize with nature by using the power of the sun and the wind We're going to burn waste that were already in landfills and get electricity out of them. So there was a desire to promote these alternative technologies that would maybe like be better for the future, for the long run, for producing electricity overall. And we're going to if we're trying to think of how to incentivize these, well, the utilities, they've had their time in the sun. There are these horrible monopolies. Now we're, you know, it's the time of the dawn of neoliberalism, and we're thinking we should actually have competition. There should be energy produced according to marginal prices, price signals that will bring people to a market and compete with each other to bring costs down, to basically strip away the fetters on production and allow these new kinds of alternative energy technologies to grow. So it starts as this sense of the utilities are bad. Their incentives are not to produce this sort of stuff, but their incentives are actually to just, as we say, grow and build. And the solution then is that these non-utility generators, these other firms, can produce power, and they will be forced, according to each state's commissions, we'll set up slightly different rules for this, but the utilities will be compelled to buy the power produced by these non-utility generators or these IPPs. So these other capitalists that just want to produce like a wind, like they got a few wind turbines and they want to squeeze out a tiny amount of power because the technology sucked back then, to then sell that power on the wholesale market to the utilities for them to sell that retail to the customers. So the utility has its own fleet of power plants. It might have a kind of pooling agreement with a neighboring utility that they're going to try to run their generators together to optimize things. So that utilities were already maybe buying power from third parties, like other utilities, and sharing power. Now this says there's a whole new kind of capitalist in the power sector, the IPP, and they're going to, because otherwise they can't sell directly to customers, so they're going to be selling to utilities by law. The utilities have to buy from them. So that is, and part of the problem there is, okay, well, what are the prices? There is no organized market yet. There's no organized wholesale market of electricity because the neoliberals haven't won yet. This is the dawn of them. Mm-hmm. So their way of getting a foot in the door with establishing kind of the price discipline, price signals everywhere, to establish these wholesale markets was to have the IPPs sell at what were called avoided costs. So every state would set up its own notion of the avoided costs. So if the utility would pay a price that was determined to be whatever the utility avoided by not producing 10 units of electrical energy themselves, instead bought 10 units of electrical energy from the IPP, whatever the avoided cost was, that's what they're going to pay. So it then became something that individual states could really sort of build up and be aggressive with if they wanted. And you might imagine California was famously the most aggressive with that, and really radically crafting policies around very generous formulas for avoided costs to promote wind and solar IPPs. I think in the early 80s is when that really happened.
I mean, it's your article is very clear, but at the same time, you know, as you read about it, it's like emerges as this amazingly baroque construction, which you think, well, is that surely the most, you know, efficient way of doing it? And you really get a glimpse into the nucleus of neoliberalism, of like the state coming in and creating markets where they didn't exist before, mm-hmm. and where there isn't a natural market. It's kind of a little bit of a struggle to kind of get your head around. And I don't know whether that's maybe a reflection of the fact that I haven't, I'm wondering whether, you know, how much of this experience is U.S. specific. I don't know if you have a sense of whether in European countries, you know, similar processes happened. I mean, I suspect in Britain it is. From my memory of living in Britain, you're sold all these different options of where you can buy your energy from, and you think, I don't want to have to choose. This isn't like an interesting consumer choice. Like I get to choose between a pair of sneakers, you know, between different brands of sneakers. This is like a choice that I never knew I wanted to have, you know?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So back in the 70s, I think it was pretty similar in a lot of places, except more lesser developed nations maybe just had true nationalization and nationalized utilities that were kind of coordinating everything. But this is all the process of deregulation is kind of the, you know, catchphrase in a lot of ways to describe this, because you're deregulating the way these commissions were setting prices to now have market set prices. But really, I think probably in the electricity sector, it's more commonly called restructuring, because it's kind of a whole like remaking of things. And famously, that really happened, I think, first in Chile, you know, surprise, surprise. Right. And then in the UK. And I think the US then was where those Chicago school economists really started convincing federal and state legislatures that there's something to the notion of taking this new classical stuff about supply and demand and prices and bringing it to the sector. So, but I want to say something more about the way you put the question, Alex, because you said, like, yes, it's complicated, and you're having a hard time getting your head around it. It's obviously very complicated. I think that, though, that speaks to another issue, which is where I really see mine and Matt's work coming in, and really what I'm trying to do in particular, which is this shit is really important in general. Forget climate change. Forget decarbonization. This is all, like, a pretty critical part of our lives, the electricity system and electricity bills and all that. It's so integral to the economy and industrial policy that you might want to have. And you never really hear about this stuff on the left. And I started getting interested in this and realizing, like, where's the writing about how all this stuff is organized?
Right.
Like, where, as I kind of learned about it, I felt like I was, like, on a journey alone. Like, where are the sources to help me figure this out? And it really was surprising to realize that at least I wasn't really aware of there's no real received wisdom on the political left for us, like, kind of Bernie bros and the Jacobin DSA AOC kind of millennial left orbit. You get no sense for how any of this is organized, how any of it works. And I think a lot of that is because this is an industrial sector where the politics of the left was so obsessed with the environmentalist movement. So the lens through which we viewed this industrial sector was environmental politics and really coming about with the new left. And I think they really just sort of formed a foundation that for various reasons is still with us today, that most of the left, when they talk about this stuff, they're talking about it from that angle, not from just like basic vanilla Marxist lens of looking at production in this sector and kind of thinking about relations of production and where's the workforce and so on like that.
Well, I mean, I guess there isn't much popular writing and thinking about this stuff anywhere, not just on the left. But I guess the point is that for the right, broadly speaking, they haven't needed it. You're right. They're not trying to, it's effectively about maintenance of the status quo. So they don't have any interest in educating people about the way this stuff works, whether from an environmental or non-environmental lens. It's just not of interest. You know, it's they're okay with things running on in the background as they have been through these kind of pseudo market systems. I am kind of curious about whether the kind of new kind of supposedly pro-worker, but, you know, kind of anti-market or post-liberal right is more active perhaps than even the left is on these questions nowadays. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but
Emmett Penny probably would be a figure to think of along those lines, though he also had his origins on the left, even though he's sort of moved to the right on that.
Former BungaCast guest, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's great. Emmett Penny.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And Meredith Angwin, I suppose, would be another one, but she's just sort of apolitical. I wouldn't peg her.
I first got in touch with Meredith to ask about Bernie Sanders' involvement in the political fight to close the Vermont nuclear power plant, and she had some very not pro-Bernie things to say about it, which I can understand. I actually had a conversation with the former head of the IBEW, the Electrical Workers Union Local, that worked at that plant, and it was probably the hardest political conversation I've had because he loathed Bernie for fighting to close this plant that provided hundreds of union jobs, carbon-free energy. I'm a Bernie bro at heart, and I'll always be a Bernie bro, but yes, that's kind of sucks.
Just a quick remark. I mean, I know Lee has a question, so Lee will come in just a sec, but it strikes me that, you know, you're referring to the fact of like being somewhat in the wilderness and trying to explore and understand how power production works, who owns what, who does what, how is it sold to whom, etc. And these questions are obviously very important, but I suspect that the left never had to think about this stuff very much, at least not in terms of asking the question of how do we get to produce more, because capital was more oriented to expanding production in its like developmental phase in rich countries anyway, in a way that the bias against production, which neoliberalism introduces, has changed that relationship. So suddenly those on the left, I mean, a very narrow segment of the left, I mean, you know, thinking about yourself, or I would like to include myself in that as well, of thinking of, okay, how do we drive forward production? How do we try to advance development again, right? Which maybe was a question for left in less developed countries. But in the rich countries, it was never really too much of a concern. Kind of capital was taking care of that. And the left was more concerned on distributional questions about questions of labor, or maybe even at its most advanced level, how to take over production, but not necessarily of how to expand production, because that was, you know, capital was doing that.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that the left, even in developed countries, through the sort of post-war period up until the 1970s, les Trente Glorieuses, when the left and the trade union movement may not have been necessarily synonymous, but very close to being synonymous, those sorts of discussions would have been the bread and butter, or rather, maybe just the water in which labor swims. So I do think that the left did think about these things, but rather put it another way, the reason the left doesn't think about it today is because the left is not of the industrial working class as much as it was at that time.
I take your point. I think it's more, I guess what I'm getting at is, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but that the left is now, kind of tasked with resolving a problem which previous generations of the left didn't have. Right, because you didn't have this kind of anti-production bias from within capital in alliance with Greens, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the way I think of it is, instead of a left that sees how do we produce what's needed, we have a left that sees how do we protect people from harm, and that's really where environmental politics comes in. How do we protect everyone from an extra molecule of carbon or something? Like, it's warranted in a lot of ways. There were in the 70s, like, I don't want to be seen as dismissing the environmental movement. Some of the victories in the 60s and 70s are absolutely critical, like cleaning up rivers, cleaning up the air. Clean air is an extremely popular, important demand that is a wonderful thing that has been cleaned up dramatically over the years. There's still work to go, but So I don't want to dismiss the interest in protecting people from harm in this environmental sense, but I do think that that is where the left has been at. And to kind of connect it to today, now, and whenever Matt and I are writing about this stuff, we kind of preface everything with, if we care about decarbonization, which is to say, do we care about reducing greenhouse gas emissions to mitigate climate change? And we have to recognize the electric sector is a really critical kind of strategic sector for decarbonization then. And that means that a lot of what is consuming energy is going to be moved to consuming electrical energy. So instead of burning fossil fuels to heat a home, we're going to consume electricity to use something to move heat around, et cetera. So electrification becomes really politically important. And I think today there's a general sense that, like, I mean, I don't agree with climate change being the number one political subject for everything. But it is the case that there's, of course, a legitimate basis for that. And there is a legitimate reason to want to grow the electric sector to meet this demand for all this new electricity. And I think that is generally accepted. So today is a left that sees, hey, the capitalists are not producing enough of this thing that needs to be produced, electricity, in a way that's equitable, but also just in terms of like sheer volume, they're not doing it.
Right.
There were two, going back to these independent power producers, the IPPs, the great promise in the 1970s, I guess, and later deregulatory efforts, was twofold. One was that it would radically reduce the costs for consumers. And the second thing, it would force the introduction of clean, of alternative energy sources against these hulking behemoths, these leviathans who refuse to move. But on both these counts, it seems, according to your essay, IPPs are just not very good at this, that IPP did not result in a lowering of costs for consumers. And they seem to struggle with offshore wind, and they don't seem to be very good at nuclear either, another clean alternative. Why have IPPs failed so badly on both these fronts?
That's a great question. So So you said something I didn't say, which is that the whole point was to have lower prices for consumers. So I think it would be unfair of me. And we try to be very fair in our assessment of all this stuff, even with the ideas we disagree with. It wasn't just that people were like, I want competition. I want to watch those capitals fight for the market. There was a theoretical basis and, of course, a political interest in that in the interest of lowering prices of electricity that consumers were paying. Now, there's consumers and there's consumers. There's some of the consumers are us, you and me, any residential customer of electricity. Then there's consumers who are Walmart or a giant aluminum smelter or Google or Amazon powering data centers and so on. They were always the ones leading the charge in the fight for restructuring or deregulating, because when you are a giant firm, you have an entire staff that is devoted to shopping around for electricity. So if there's a market for electricity that has competition and you have people whose entire jobs and training are about shopping on that market, of course you're going to like find a way to save money that way. But as Alex was saying earlier, like it's a choice that he didn't know he actually needed or wanted to like shop between this provider and that provider for the electricity that comes in the single line into his home. So I would say it did lead, the process of deregulation or restructuring in the U.S. did lead to lower prices for industrial customers slightly. There's various, it's, I think, methodologically like complicated to argue conclusively either way, but there is evidence to suggest that for industrial customers, it did go down a bit, but for residential customers, no, it didn't really. Not real prices anyway. So that's one thing. The next is the question of, did the IPPs actually succeed in building the clean energy? So I actually would say when it comes to certain of these alternative energy technologies, it absolutely did improve that. Like, it really is the case that, removing the fetters on capitalism to allow these IPPs to kind of duke it out with each other and have a guaranteed market, utilities, to sell power to, they did develop wind technology really extensively over, like, if you were to look at a wind turbine in 1982 versus today, it's a dramatic change. I would say it did stimulate improvements in that, in wind turbine technology, solar photovoltaic energy technology, although that really came exploded a bit later. Some biomass when you're burning like wood or waste or something. But, and here's the kicker that people like to ignore. One of the major alternative technologies was just natural gas powered turbines. Like, literally take a jet engine, turn it into a power plant. You have natural gas coming in, combust it, spin the turbine. You can do that. You can turn that on pretty quickly and produce a lot of power that way. So they did lead to all sorts of really interesting technical improvements in this technology. It's like, you know, if we remove the questions of ownership and for what purpose and stuff, it's pretty interesting how all these like power technologies came about. Now, the other part of what you said, though, is like nuclear. So the things I was just saying are rather small scale technologies, because the whole point was, I'm just some random firm and I'm going to find a little plot of land to like have my little thing there to sell a marginal amount of energy to some utility. They weren't tasked with providing a public service. They weren't public utilities. They weren't having to run the whole damn grid. They could just provide as much little here and there as they wanted and get a price for that, or get revenues for that. So when it comes to the big things, the IPPs have never in America, I would presume, I don't think anywhere else, but at least in America, no IPP has ever built a nuclear plant. there are IPPs who own nuclear plants today because they bought them from utilities when in some places, some states, utilities were forced to divest all of their generation assets. So they sold them to IPPs. And it's not just because like the particular people and companies in the IPPs aren't interested in building nuclear. No, some of them are absolutely interested. Like the ones that own a lot of nuclear today would build nuclear. But the fact that they're IPPs is just a completely different organization of political economy of like in terms of financing and things. They can't build these big things. Because if you're going to build a nuclear plant, you want to have a guarantee that over decades, because this thing will last 60, 80 years, over decades, I'm going to have a guaranteed customer base that has to buy the power. They have to give me revenues for the power that is being generated by this plant. And they're not going to like find a cheaper price somewhere else and go somewhere else unless they're like physically relocating production, which maybe they could do if they're like some industrial customer. So if I have that guaranteed monopoly franchise, I have, again, something I can take to the bank to raise the enormous, like, you know, tens of billions of dollars for a large conventional nuclear power plant to then go to the bank and raise the capital for that and know that I'm going to recoup the investment. If you take out the capitalists and think of the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is, I'm very happy to see some recent reporting in HuffPost by Alex Kaufman recently. They do have some interest in building new large conventional nuclear plants to supplement their seven existing reactors. They still have a question of they need to know that they have a long-term customer base that will be forced to buy that power. And there are interesting political things going on today that's happening in order for them to keep that fact. But to go back to your question, like an IPP just doesn't have that because they're just sellers on a market. They're not providing a public service. They don't have any monopolies. They don't have any guaranteed customers. So it's just a different way for them to operate, which means it's just different how they could potentially build the big infrastructure like that.
And so this is also the capital intensive nature of nuclear power plants. The problem there with respect to IPPs presumably also follows with other forms of clean alternative energy that is capital intensive. So I'm thinking hydroelectric dams, but also offshore wind, which is still intermittent, but it's less intermittent than onshore wind. And you write in the piece, there's an interesting little passage here about the struggles that IPPs are having with building offshore wind. Maybe you could go into a little bit more detail there. Whereas I think it was in Virginia, where there's still this vertically integrated utility, they are not having any issues with that. In fact, they're even building their own boats. Is that right?
Yeah, boats. It's like a little sailboat, when you put it that way. It's not a sailboat. It's a massive industrial ship. But yeah, absolutely. So this is how we open the recent damage essay, The Utility of Utilities, is talking about the offshore wind comparison here. So offshore, and I agree, offshore wind, it requires much more of a kind of local workforce for operations and maintenance and like high paid jobs, because that's really dangerous and sophisticated work to keep offshore wind turbines repaired and everything. And it is overall producing more bang for the buck compared to land-based wind. So I'm softly in favor of offshore wind, but it frustrates me when people want offshore wind because they only will want to have new renewable energy and like not nuclear. So offshore wind, absolutely an example of massive infrastructure that is extremely expensive to build. And the U.S. is kind of a laggard on getting the industry going. So in the Northeast Atlantic states, these are basically all restructured electricity systems there in markets. Let's say New York State. So the way you approach the question of how do we get offshore wind and wind power built in New York State, which is part of the state's climate legislation. There's a demand for X number of gigawatts of offshore wind by a certain time. If you're a place like New York, you have to rely on IPPs to build offshore wind, these developers. Why aren't they today? Well, partly the federal government owns the water, and so the federal government has to auction off leases for the rights to be in the water in order for a private developer to build the offshore wind turbines in those waters. But the federal government has generally lately been, especially under Biden, very supportive of leasing these out. So these IPPs are not coming to build offshore wind. They're not chomping at the bit to build offshore wind today, even though there's this power market where they could forecast, oh, we could earn, we see power prices are roughly this, and we see a market need for offshore wind, so we're going to build it and recoup our investment and benefit the shareholders. They're not doing that today because it's not a, maybe they're too risk averse. There's just not interest from them in doing that. There's not enough of a profit to be had, guaranteed, to do that. So instead, you got to like juice the market. So you're the state. You have to now have a subsidy on top of the market to attract these developers. So now I'm New York State. I'm going to say there's a thing called an offshore wind renewable energy certificate. And every unit of energy generated by an offshore wind project off New York State doesn't just produce the power that you could sell. It also produces the certificate that you could sell. We're now going to mandate a certain amount of offshore renewable energy certificates, OREX, to be produced in the state, and all of the state's utilities have to buy them. And then the utilities are going to spread the cost of those to all of the state's electricity consumers. So on everyone in New York State's utility bill, there's going to be a tiny little charge that is their share of buying these offshore renewable energy certificates via the state agency from the offshore wind developers that are going to come in and build the offshore wind. So that is an additional revenue stream to the developers that then makes it an interesting prospect for them to sell offshore wind power into the markets to whoever, just as they would with any other power plant. And the state, to solicit these IPPs, not only designs that policy instrument, not only has the law that requires utilities to purchase them and distribute those costs to customers, they have to also design the competitive auction process in order to select, because it's not an infinite amount of space. You have to kind of pick. Someone is going to get the rights to this plot of the water to build offshore wind turbines to sell. So they have to run a competitive auction where they have different developers compete for basically the subsidy, not for the power, but the subsidy. They're going to say, we'll do it for this price for the subsidy. And so it's ultimately about competition. And what has happened over the past year or so is that because of upstream supply chain problems and inflation and all that, the cost of to the developer, to the IPP of building the offshore wind stuff has risen dramatically. And now the agreed upon price for the subsidy and what they can see from the market, let's say the market prices are actually going down. Well, that's bad for them. They want high prices to sell. They were then seeing, shit, this isn't profitable for us anymore. So they were asking to renegotiate the contracts for the subsidies to get a higher price for the subsidies to make the project still profitable to them. New York State's response was, hell no, this is about competition. We can't just start allowing renegotiation. And legitimately, like, yeah, if you start allowing renegotiation, the developer might be like, oh, that's going to be another $500 per subsidy. This is looking tough. So go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I was just wondering, you know, listening to you talk about this, that I don't know if there is industrialist pressure on producers or on the state, you know, to increase production. And presumably that isn't part of the kind of contemporary political ecosystem. Because I'm thinking, you know, if there isn't pressure, I'm just trying to kind of think about the politics of this and what has kind of generated or what sustains this arrangement, which, you know, just listening to you describe it, sounds so, as I said, kind of baroque and complicated and unnecessary, that like, where's the pressure coming from to kind of to change this, you know, like is someone going, mm-hmm. well, you know, we need more energy kind of, so can someone sort this out?
Yeah, so the pressure comes from like environmental groups who say it's a climate emergency. We need the offshore wind now, not later. So do whatever it takes to get this now and not later. That's one source. Another source is organized labor is a big proponent of all this. So when you have all this offshore wind development, you need lots of local development and manufacturing in different shipping centers and hubs because some of the components of the turbines, not all of them, are going to be produced onshore in America and say in New York State, and you're going to have like a home base in this port and have things shipped out and installed over there. So the unions see a lot of new jobs and industrial work that's long-term, not like putting up some solar panels and then moving on to the next territory. This is a long-term, like kind of upstream supply chain work. So they're very in favor. And Matt and I have heard from a group in another, in somewhere in the mid-Atlantic, I don't want to reveal too much, but they were saying the unions are actually very concerned that these offshore wind projects are so tenuous that they're not guaranteed, because they really want this for their members. This is big industrial work that would be long-term stuff. So they want that. So there is some political pressure on making it happen with certain conditions. Like, and in New York State, there are like project labor agreements so that any of this work has to be done with kind of signing a labor agreement about the conditions and the pay and all that. Like, it is good work for unions. So they're very interested. And the developers, like anyone involved in the supply chain, is very interested. But there's also a lot of risk, because there are just these supply chain issues. One issue that was plaguing, I think not in New York, but another mid-Atlantic offshore wind project. I think Siemens, the German manufacturer of the blades, was banking on having even larger blades. Like every year, it's like, we have a new larger blade and you can get more power per turbine. They thought they were going to have an even bigger one, and the project is being designed around that bigger blade. But it turns out there was a lot of quality control problems with what they were producing. And actually, a lot of them were breaking down and had to be like under warranty sent back to Siemens. So Siemens lost a lot of money. They have their own kind of crisis of producing this stuff at large enough scale. So what happens is you now have to go back to the older, smaller turbine, blades. Now you need more turbines with slightly smaller blades to get the same amount of power out of it. And it just completely changes the kind of costs and the power output of these projects. And again, because they're all based on these contracts for the subsidies, it just ends up hurting the developer. So the risk is on the developer that they're not going to be able to profit enough from that.
So labor seems to be definitely in favor of offshore wind for all the reasons that you said, but they're not big fans of utility competition, of the IPPs. In your piece, you have this great quote from one union official saying, "This is our NAFTA." Why was that? Why did the deregulation, the restructuring, have such a negative impact on labor? Why couldn't the trade unions just take their contracts with them to the broken up units of the old integrated utilities?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So this is our NAFTA quote. It was from the late 90s. Because over the course of the 90s, like in every state, there were different, not in every state, in many states across the U.S., there were attempts by legislatures and governors to try to break up their utility monopolies and introduce competition of generation, of like power plants. In some places, that meant forcing utilities to divest the generation assets and sell them to IPPs. So what we heard in the essay, we interviewed Jim Harrison at the Utility Workers Union of America. The way he was telling it is that it's just not even true that if a union has a collective bargaining agreement with a utility that covers the employees at some power plant, then some IPP buys the power plant. It wasn't even necessarily the case that the collective bargaining agreement stays in place. Sometimes it just disappeared. So that meant they now have to, or even if that didn't happen, regardless, they would have 50 years of labor and management relations and history of these collective bargaining agreements they've built up over the years with these utilities, where they're representing so in New York City, Con Edison is the big utility in New York City. And when they owned all the power plants around there, because they had the monopoly, they had, I think it was around 10,000 employees and members. 10,000 members of the Utility Workers Union Local 1-2. When Con Edison sold a lot of the power plants, when New York State's electricity system was deregulated, a lot of those employees now went to new owners, and they were kind of cast to the, you know, into the winds and these different owners. And so the large employer meant having these large collective bargaining agreements for a master agreement of like covering a lot of workers. Now that's broken down into smaller ones, and all these different units with different employers had to now form new relationships with new management that are just like starting fresh. And that didn't lead to good conditions for the union. They had a much better setup before. But there's another key aspect here, which is that if you're a utility, again, you profit, you get a return on the capital invested. All of the operational costs of operating the power plants and maintaining the lines, paying the staff and all that stuff is all socialized costs that your utility, everyone's utility bills eventually make up for. So the utility bills make up for the total costs, capital plus operational costs, plus a margin of return that is allowed for the shareholders. You know, tip the hat, shareholders, there you go. That meant that there was not really the same downward pressure on wages that exists in a normal market and normally in the economy with normal capitalists. When you have competition, the capitalists, like one firm's profit is based on whatever, if they can lower their costs so that the same revenue now means more profit. So competition leads to downward pressure on wages that simply didn't exist with utilities. So that's another reason that unions really dislike IPPs. They resent that their industry was broken up in this way. And still today, a lot of wind and solar work, there might be unions involved in construction. The IBEW has in California and New York State, where they have kind of political influence, they can get a lot of work installing solar panels and requirements that work be good for like basically union. But everywhere else, the operational work, it's not many jobs, but even the jobs that are there to operate and maintain them are mostly non-union because it's mostly not utilities. So utility often means union work, non-utility, and IPP often means non-union work. So to return to the, now, so we're talking about utility versus IPP and how they do things differently and how the way they earn profits is different. If we return to that example of offshore wind, and we talked about how New York State, they want offshore wind, they need to attract an IPP to come develop it for them with a competitive auction process and with these additional subsidies that they're still going to socialize the cost of to the state's consumers. In Virginia, where there is a vertically integrated regulated utility, there's also an open wholesale market that Virginia is part of, but so it's not like super, super vertically integrated monopoly. It's like somewhere in between. But still, the public utility there, it's owned by investors, but you know, we're calling it a utility, Dominion, they were tasked by the state. The state decided we want offshore wind. And there was essentially legislation that compelled the public utilities like Dominion to build offshore wind. So what does Dominion do? They say, ooh, that's a lot of capital. We're gonna get some juicy profits on that investment if we're doing that. So now they have an incentive to build the offshore wind, and they can do it at such a massive scale. Their project is the largest of all the Atlantic Coast offshore wind projects, and they're doing it at such a scale that they can, it's affordable, not affordable, but they can just pay for the ship, the vessel that's going to be used to install the turbines into the seabed floor.
The boat.
They can build the boat, their little sailboat, they can build it themselves and own that boat. Whereas the smaller projects and the competitive developers, they can't build their own boats. They have a fixed price that they have to sell into, and the profits or whatever's left over after that. There's not enough boats to install turbines across the Atlantic coast in America. Part of that is because of a 100-year-old law called the Jones Act that says a ship that is flagged for the U.S., a ship that is not flagged U.S. cannot go from one U.S. port to another U.S. port. It's an obscure old labor legislation that's a century old, but that is why there's not enough offshore wind vessels, because they're simply not American made anymore. So Dominion has a ship built, and it sailed out of Texas a few weeks ago and is now up at the coast of Virginia and is starting to install some of the big infrastructure into the seabed. And any of these costs are now going to be for one, they are approved by the State Commission of Virginia. It's not just that whatever Dominion wants they're going to get, the commission is going to make sure that the investments are prudent. And any of the costs, let's say that you have an issue with the blades, it's going to cost a bit more. The commission can then determine, okay, it now becomes a political question. How much of that increase in the cost are we still going to socialize on top of all the other costs to the consumers over the next few decades? And how much are we going to force this utility shareholders to eat? And, you know, I would like to say that, you know, with there's political muscle from the people and the popular forces to make the shareholders eat it. Probably that's not usually the case, but at least it becomes a political question as part of the public process. And at the end of the day, if theirs is proceeding, the Dominion Virginia offshore wind project, it is proceeding, it's not being canceled, they have more competition, and it's the biggest.
So there was a bit of a spicy line in your piece, I thought. At one point you write, I'm going to quote the whole thing here, though socialists think flatly about the profit motive as the problem to core, there are disparate models of profit-making that shape institutional capacities for building the long-term infrastructure and organized workforces we need. But where the utility model exists today, many seek to drive it out. So that's the end of your quote. My question is, why should the left think about a restoration of this investor-owned utility model and not just jump straight to calling for public ownership? Isn't this still just capitalism?
Great question. So obviously, you know, I, as a socialist, I would like it to be public ownership. Where does the institutional capacity to run something as unbelievably complicated and essential and kind of like emergency needed stuff as an electric utility, like where do you get the public capacity to do that? So it's just a huge lift and a huge challenge. I would like to push for that wherever possible, but I think we have to find where it exists and try to expand that. Building like a public takeover of, let's say, Dominion Energy, I just don't, like I said, I don't know where it comes from. And especially today, if we look at all progressive forces, that would generally be like, boo, investors are taking too much out of the economy. They are not interested in this. They're interested in small-scale decentralization. They're not interested in the big stuff, like maybe was the impulse during the New Deal. So for one, I think it's just a practical necessity that we have to, on the one hand, hope for that and expand it where it exists, but I think not rely on that to be the answer. I could tell you, we're going to nationalize it, but I would be just like every other leftist out there, and I think it's just not as useful.
They're sort of like, we have to start from where we're starting from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And where we're starting from is there are places in the country that have public ownership of local utilities. But then also there's the big public power, as you mentioned, the TVA in Bonneville does exist today. I would say a political reason for the left to be interested in fighting for even investor-owned utilities over more competition is that, for one, it is a way to side with organized labor, which does have political power still in this country. The utility sector and like electricity sector is something like a quarter of employees are unionized. Like, that's the union density. That is way higher than the like 10% or whatever is the national average for all workforce. So it's a way to join a coalition with industrial unions. It is also a recognition that if we want to have the massive nationwide remaking of the landscape to have clean energy infrastructure, to clean up things that are too carbon emitting, while also providing new industrial development, all sorts of jobs, union jobs in that. You need steam fitters, you need pipe fitters, you need all sorts of work for that kind of thing. And the whole point here has been that the profit-making model of utilities is just more conducive to that kind of massive industrial growth than the competitive model. Another element here is that you can't just put in a generator here and then like, I wanted to build it, so I built it. Now it's there and I'm going to sell the power. The electrical grid is like, it is so interconnected and requires constant balancing. If you turn on a light switch, I think we had a quote in our Catalyst essay. I hope I get the right Canadian province here. It depends on which exact grid it's part of. But I think it was in Newfoundland. If you turn on a light switch.
Newfoundland.
Who can remember these things? If you flip a light switch on, there's an infinitesimal tug on a nuclear power plant in Miami because it's all part of the Eastern interconnection. Like, it is so interconnected that you can't just willy-nilly plug and play like a, you know, a USB appliance into the grid. They all have to be very rigorously studied for to make sure you don't upset the resiliency of the bulk power system of the electrical grid. And that is something we should uphold. There are people who say that this is a conservative talking point to oppose renewables. That's complete bullshit. It's insane to say that we should risk the resilience of the of something so essential to like life and also to like to homes, to hospitals, and production in general.
So another example of complete ignorance of these systems.
Exactly. Yeah. So this the process by which a owner or some entity of some part of the larger electrical grid studies whether a prospective generator or big new data center or something will still result in a reliable electrical grid, that is insanely complicated and requires a lot of bureaucracy and technical capacities. And for reasons I'm not going to get into, wind and solar generators are of a particular kind that make it even harder because you don't have these massive spinning machines generating electricity. It's a fundamentally different quality of electricity coming out. So it complicates things. So I think the emphasis should be on the big stuff. And if the utilities are the ones that are leading the charge, they have the kind of central little planning units and divisions to have an overview of the grid that they sort of manage their part of, to then say, we know that this belongs here. We need a generator there, and we need a generator there. We're going to build it.
And additionally, of course, if the overriding aim for environmentalists is complete decarbonization, for that to happen, some section of the grid has to be firm to maintain this reliability. And it sounds like IPPs just cannot produce anything that is both firm and clean. The only firm that they seem to be able to do is natural gas, I think you were saying. So that's surely another great reason to convince environmentalists to get on board with the virtually integrated model. So there does seem to be a bit of good news, though, in recent years with Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, a sort of soft version, attenuated version of a Green New Deal. And it appears to have overturned the, or at least to some extent, the more than 40-year bias against these utilities, these integrated utilities. Could you explain what's happened there and what really needs to make it go a little bit further in terms of a preservation and extension of this model?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is an important thing to recognize what's important about the Inflation Reduction Act and its reform of the tax credits. And yes, we can all oppose the way tax credits are the way we have little like mini industrial policy, but this is an important reform if what we care about is public power and utility development. So historically, these tax credits for renewable energy since the 90s, or early 90s, they have been awarded to these IPPs. So if you invest in a wind turbine and or a solar panel, you get X percent of the investment is a tax credit to you. Or if you produce one unit of energy, then X percent of that is a tax credit. X percent of some amount of that is a tax credit you're going to get back. This, for a long time, for one, it has never applied to tax-exempt entities. What if you don't pay taxes to the federal government? Too bad. There's nothing for you then. So the TVA, local electrical utilities, they have never been able to benefit from this. So that is a big reason why, for them, they haven't been building this stuff themselves. And if they do, they contract it out. They have a third party own it. If you look at Nebraska, which is historically like all public power, a quarter of its generation today is from third party owned wind and solar, or mostly wind generators, because they're the ones who can build it more cheaply because they get those federal incentives. So for one, the Inflation Reduction Act has what's called direct pay or elective pay of most of the clean energy tax credits, so that even if you're not paying taxes, you just get the money not for free, but like you get it from the IRS essentially. So that's one major way that public power, like this levels the playing field for public power entities like the TVA and your local utility, municipal utility, to benefit from federal clean energy incentives. Like, it is literally 30 years of this regime being built up where that has been lopsided and public power was denied the benefits. They are now getting it. That is incredible. So the other point, though, is that the utilities can also benefit because there's very technical reasons why these tax credits were not really monetizable by the utilities in the same way. it gets into kind of accounting law and all this yada yada. So now what's happening is that the tax credits are something that can be transferred. So it's actually also kind of shitty because literally it's a commodification of public subsidy. If I am earning a tax credit for a renewable energy investment, I can just sell it to you. And now you can claim it on your taxes and get the benefit from it. And I might sell it to you for, it might be worth like a dollar, but I sell it to you for 90 cents or something. And now, because it's profitable for you to get a dollar off your taxes, no, sorry, the other way around. If it's profitable for you to get a dollar off your tax bill, so you might pay a dollar 10 to get that credit from me. So because it's like kind of introducing this weird marketplace of tax credits, that means that utilities now have a way to sell the tax credits that they get. Because utilities often don't pay very high federal taxes. They pay a lot in property taxes. So they don't have high tax bills. So that if they were to like build a nuclear plant, and let's say they got like, you know, $1 billion in tax credits over the lifetime of the plant, they don't necessarily have billion dollars of federal taxes they're paying to even make use of that. Now they can simply sell the credit. So on the one hand, I really am disgusted that that's kind of the setup, but I'm also encouraged that this is helping level the playing field also for utilities to start developing more wind and solar and clean energy and so on and benefiting from it.
All right. Excellent. Great stuff. I thought that was hugely informative and made clear something that, as I have repeated at several points, it seems, you know, amazingly opaque, baroque, etc. But it is interesting that the worm seems to be turning at least a little bit. And, you know, I think the it's always worth referring back to kind of what happened in the 1970s, where the public was softened up, I think, for a different approach. And we're probably in a similar situation today, at least the kind of, it seems that the political opportunity is there for a kind of radically different approach to energy production. Fred, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Lee.